argument this morning is Crockett against Hewlett. Mr. Hastert.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Ethan Hastert for Petitioner Appellant Fraser Crockett. The crucial question before the jury during Mr. Crockett's trial was whether Crockett was actively involved in the shooting or merely a bystander. The jury demonstrated its view that the answer to that question turned on the meaning of the word abet. The jury asked for a dictionary, and when that request was denied, it asked for a definition of abet. The trial judge notified the state of that request, but for some reason failed to notify defense.
But, of course, the Illinois courts found that the judge instructed the sheriff to go find the defense lawyers. We don't really know why the sheriff didn't succeed in doing so within whatever the time period may have been, 15 minutes to an hour. But the state court said that the sheriff was told to go find the defense lawyers, which is the right move for the judge, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor. But we would posit.
So you're saying it's actually constitutional error that the judge didn't simultaneously send a note back to the jury saying, you must take a recess right now while I try to find defense lawyers.
No, Your Honor. We think that, too, would be error. The correct course, to take your first question, whether or not the court itself discharged its duty by notifying the sheriff, I think that places the focus on the wrong parties. Here the focus should be on the defendant, here petitioner Mr. Crockett. It was his rights that were violated by the court failing to notify him. Whether the focus should be on the judge or the deputy, I think misplaces where the real focus should be.
Well, but why is that true? Suppose the judge had said to the sheriff, please go tell, you know, go call on their cell phones the defense lawyers. And so the sheriff said okay and went back and sat down in office and proceeds to call. And 4 minutes later, you know, while one of the defense lawyers is coming back from ordering some food or whatever they were doing, this restaurant, the jury comes back. Now, there's no constitutional error in that scenario, is there?
Well, we would say that first of all, those aren't the facts before.
You're saying that only if somehow the judge succeeds in getting through to the defense lawyers and the defense lawyers then have time to respond even on the cell phone. Now, let's assume it's a quick response. Let's not assume that it takes forever to research these things or anything. They have, you know, they're well prepared, so they know. But I still don't see where's the constitutional problem with the fact that as it unfolded, no response was ever made for this definition of a vet.
Well, it is a constitutional error for the court to fail to notify the defendant of a note by a jury. The question, I believe what Your Honor is getting at, is whether or not that was reasonable for the court to fail to notify a defendant. We would say that it is not. A quick phone call, it takes 2 seconds to pick up a cell phone and say, defense counsel, we have a note from a jury. This is what it says. It asks for a definition of the word abet. What are your thoughts? It would have taken 2 seconds for defense counsel to say, judge, we request that you notify the jury to cease deliberations. We'll be back to the courthouse in short order. We can get together with the prosecution and yourself, Your Honor, and we can research this issue and instruct the jury so that they have.
All those are things the judge might have said. What decision of the Supreme Court clearly establishes that the judge must do those things?
Your Honor, the case of U.S. v. Rogers?
U.S. against Rogers says the judge can't communicate ex parte with the jury.
Correct.
You have a completely different line of argument. What you were saying here is several things. One, the communication with the defense counsel and the defendant must be prompt, as you're defining prompt. And two, that the judge should tell the jury to stop deliberating. I'm asking what decision of the Supreme Court clearly establishes that judges must do those things.
Your Honor, again, I believe Rogers against the U.S.
That issue is not remotely presented in Rogers.
But it's based on a defendant's right to counsel and to be present during all critical stages of his jury trial.
Counsel, you're not listening to my question. When the judge instructs the jury, counsel has to be consulted, the defendant has to be present. The question I'm asking is, what decision of the Supreme Court establishes a time limit for doing these things or requires the judge to tell the jury to stop deliberating.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, nothing. Nothing to our knowledge.
That's consistent with my own understanding. Rogers certainly does not. But now this gives us a problem under the AEDPA, which says that in collateral review, a federal court can implement only law, quote, clearly established by the Supreme Court of the United States. So we're back to the question, what clearly establishes the propositions you need to win here, which have to do with expedition in answering or with telling the jury to stop deliberating while an answer is impending?
Yes, Your Honor. The Section 2254d1 does talk about an unreasonable application of federal law as established.
As clearly established by the Supreme Court, right? If the Supreme Court has never said there is a time limit, then the state can't be unreasonable in implementing the non-existent law.
But it's our position, Your Honor, that under Rogers and cases like it, that...
Look, Rogers is as totally irrelevant as you can imagine. The proposition, do not do X before allowing the defendant to comment, has nothing to do with the proposition, you must do X quickly.
Understood,
Your
Honor.
I hope you see my point. I appreciate your argument that this is a good principle, but you know what happened to this court the last time we extended a Supreme Court case to a good principle. We got summarily reversed in a very nasty opinion by the Supreme Court, right against Van Patten, asking us what we had been smoking.
Yes, Your Honor. But it cannot be right that Rogers says that a trial judge has to notify defense counsel before he further instructs a jury, and then say that he doesn't have to instruct the jury when, especially under Illinois law, where...
Sorry, we don't enforce Illinois law.
Understood, Your Honor.
But, and it does happen. You know, a jury might send a question out, but this jury obviously decided that notwithstanding that it had this question, it was going to keep on deliberating. It did, and it came to a verdict. And I'm not sure that the Supreme Court has ever said that that's an impermissible manner of proceeding for a state court.
Again, we would argue that it was required to notify Mr. Crockett's counsel, and that its failure to do so was unreasonable. It clearly cannot be correct that the court can notify the prosecution and fail to notify the defense and still be in the right. I notice that I'm running into my rebuttal time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hastert. Mr. Levin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Eric Levin on behalf of the respondent appellee, Donald Hulick. First of all, to address Judge Wood's hypothetical of what if the time interval between the question and the verdict had been 4 minutes, would that have been unreasonable? The one thing I would point out on that score is that if we look at one of the affidavits submitted by Belinda on the issue of the timeline, this is on page SA-176 of the supplemental appendix submitted by the petitioner. She states in that affidavit that the jury waited 30 minutes for their answer to the first question, and that was a question that was answered over the phone. And petitioner hasn't argued that there was some sort of unreasonable delay in contacting them for that first question.
I don't understand how knowing how long it took the judge to answer the first question tells us how long it took the judge not to answer the third or fourth question. I'm a little surprised that the state court does not timestamp things. You get a note from the jury, you note on it when it was delivered. The jury says we've got a verdict. You note when the verdict comes back. And I'm surprised that Illinois would run its courts in a way that left this up in the air.
It would have made the issue here much easier to resolve.
Or not. One of the jurors apparently estimated that the verdict, that they found a verdict an hour after they asked this question. Other estimates were shorter.
Yes. And if you look at Belinda's affidavit, which actually gives the most detailed timeline of what happened, she says, and this is sort of consistent with what the counsel and the judge said at the hearing, is that they went out at 1 and came back at 4. Belinda says that they deliberated for 20 minutes, then went to lunch for 30 minutes. So that's 50 minutes right there. She then says that for the remainder of those deliberations, which is a little over 2 hours, she says that halfway through those deliberations, they sent out their first two questions. So that puts us already at about an hour and 50 minutes. She says they then waited 30 minutes for a response to those two questions. So that puts us now at about 2 hours, 20 minutes. And 5 minutes after, she says 5 minutes after getting the response to those first two questions, they then sent out the third question. And then she says they waited about 15 minutes and then reached their verdict, which would put the verdict at about 3:45. The court said that it received the verdict about 4 o'clock. So the taking her timeline, the 15 minutes to 30-minute interval, seems a little more consistent than the one-hour interval. Even under the one-hour interval, though, petitioner hasn't demonstrated how that would be unreasonable or how they could have, you know, the petitioner didn't make any sort of record of this in the state court, and the state held that it was the defendant's burden to make that record. That's a holding that that's an issue of state law. The petitioner didn't challenge that on direct appeal. He didn't, in his PLA, he didn't argue that the state appellate court erroneously put the burden of making that record on him, which that brings us to the 2254D2 question, which asks, were the state court's factual findings an unreasonable determination of fact in light of the evidence presented in state court? And in light of the evidence presented in state court, I don't see how we can say that it was unreasonable for the state court to find that there was a lack of diligence or there was unreasonable delay.
Of course, the state court ticks off quite a few things that seemingly are important on which there is absolutely no evidence at all, and then they just throw their hands up and say, well, the burden is on Crockett, which doesn't seem to be correct, and so we'll put the risk of uncertainty on him.
Well, I think the burden is on Crockett because we're not talking about a harmless error question here. What we're talking about, in this sense, the unreasonable delay or the lack of diligence is actually a part of the error. And in that sense, I think the burden would be on the defendant to establish the unreasonable delay.
I thought the state courts were pretty clear that there was a problem here. They just said that they thought it was harmless. So I think we are, in fact, talking about harmless error.
No, I think that is the state courts said there was a problem with failing to notify post-verdict. With respect to the failure to notify pre-verdict, the court actually said there was no error there.
But the post-verdict problem is precisely when you say Mr. Crockett's lawyers should have been out there developing the record and collecting evidence and the like. So I guess I still have some concern about this.
Well, the first thing I would note on page SA-164 of the supplemental appendix, this is a transcript of the post-trial hearing, Crockett's counsel says that he discovered the note the next day. We also know that one of the affidavits he got from one of the jurors that was submitted with his post-trial motion was dated, I think, somewhere between 2 and 3 weeks after the trial. So he clearly had time, and then they had another 3 months or so before the actual hearing.
State court says 4 months. Yeah.
4 months. I think the post-trial hearing was the beginning of November. The verdict was end of June. So he had plenty of time. He got three affidavits. He's now just speculating about what he says he could have gotten more affidavits. They could have been more clear about the timeline. Belinda seems pretty clear in her. I mean, she's actually able to tick off, we did this, we did that, and give times, which seem consistent with what the both lawyers and the judge said at the hearing about their recollection of events. In terms of getting more affidavits, this also goes to our point that anything they get in the affidavits concerning their misunderstanding or their erroneous understanding of what the word meant, that's not admissible to attack the verdict in any case. They could have maybe gotten more affidavits on the timeline, but they wouldn't have gotten anything that said, you know, we waited 2 or 3 hours. That just doesn't fit within what we know about the timeline. So that certainly wouldn't have provided any clear and convincing evidence to upset the state court's factual findings. I would also just point out briefly, and we make this argument in our brief, even if we did consider what the jurors said in their affidavits concerning their understanding of the law, what they said they did is consistent with what further instructions would have been given if there had been time to give instructions and if instructions had been given.
It's hard for me to see how we can consider their account of their substantive deliberations, actually.
I agree that they're clearly inadmissible. I would just, even if they were considered, but I agree that they're not admissible. In this case, the IPI instruction that was given on accountability was a correct statement of the law. It was clear. It was not ambiguous in any way. Petitioner's counsel...
Not to a lawyer. I mean, I read it and I thought, well, suppose you have a lay jury, the kind of jury that's sending the notes back that were sent back in this case that do not seem to me to reflect somebody with graduate education. They may not have known where the line... I mean, there are actual courses in law school that teach you about the line between abetting and mere presence. So...
That is correct, but I would note here that, first of all, simply from saying what does the word abet mean, there's really no way the trial court, I mean, now petitioner's coming back and based on the affidavit saying, well, they were confused about mere presence and whether that was sufficient. There's really no way that the judge would have known that that was the problem they were having, if they were having any sort of problem like that, simply by asking for what the word abet meant. And on that point, I would note that in the jury instruction conference, petitioner's counsel never requested a mere presence instruction. They point out this was, you know, their theory of the defense is that he was merely present, but they didn't even request an instruction on that at the conference. The evidence that was presented here was clearly sufficient to find petitioner guilty, and they haven't made any sort of sufficiency of the evidence argument here. Again, I would just quickly point out, as the court recognized, that they haven't met their burden under 2254D1 of pointing to any clearly established Supreme Court case law that would get them over that hurdle. Also, their argument about the post-verdict error that the state court recognized, that being a structural error, I think our brief explains why that's simply not a structural error, that the courts haven't recognized that as a structural error, and this court couldn't now for the first time on collateral review classify this as a structural error. If there are no questions, I would ask that the court affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Levin. Anything further, Mr. Hester?
I'd like to point out that under Section 2254 D2, Mr. Crockett would be entitled to relief because the court's failure to notify defense counsel of the jury note requesting a definition of the bet was clearly unreasonable, and it's unreasonable given the facts that were presented to the Illinois Appellate Court.
Are you focusing on the pre-verdict or the post-verdict?
Pre-verdict, Your Honor.
Okay.
Under Illinois law, Crockett was entitled to be notified of the jury note.
Sorry, we don't enforce Illinois law. I don't understand where you think you're going.
Under Section 2254 D2, I believe, or we posit that the facts as presented in the state court on direct appeal were unreasonably applied. And again, we go back to the facts that were stated earlier that the court had plenty of time to notify defense counsel. It would have taken no time to pick up a phone and notify them. And in that instance, defense counsel could have argued for an instruction to postpone or cease deliberations and await further instruction. Further, that error is definitely harmful. Considering the jury's apparent confusion over an issue critical to the case and the law of accountability in Illinois as it was presented in the trial court, it is clear that the trial judge's error was harmful to Crockett. The instruction, and I'm almost out of time, but I'd like to point out that the instruction clearly had a bet in it. He had to have knowingly solicited, aided, or abetted in the crime, and the jury's confusion on that point was clearly harmful. And I'd also like to point out, Your Honor pointed out, the Illinois Appellate Court failed to apply Chapman and inappropriately placed the burden on Crockett, and that was definitely an error. If the Court has any questions, I'd be happy to address them at this time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Mr. Hastert, we appreciate your willingness and that of Mayor Brown to undertake the appointment in this case, and the assistance you've been both to your client and the Court.
Thank you, Your Honors.
The case is taken under advisement.